If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. You better watch out.
Arr. It's Space Pirate Radio time. Buckos here on Astronomy.fm Radio. That must mean it is another Wednesday evening, and this one just happens to be Wednesday, February the 22nd, 2017. 1 minute past 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So universal time, that would be 2:01 in the morning on Thursday, February the 23rd. Universal time. So that means we're live right now, and that means crew, come on over and start boarding, which is code for come on into the chat room, astronomy.fm/chat. I'll get you the login page, or go to the home page, and you'll be here. Join us. Come on in the chat room. We're going to put links for the articles that we talk about. You can ask us questions right on the air. Well, we'll read your questions on the air as long as we catch them in time. And say hi to you when you come on into our chat room, too. So let's do that right now. Welcome aboard, crew. We've got me, Black Projects. I got Nick, Twist Edge, Glenn, sort of anonymous, 803302. That's what happens when you just click without typing your name. Evil Spock, you, Observing Space, Plaid Sister, Plaid Joan. Welcome, everybody, so far. And I know there will be more people coming and going as the evening goes on. So welcome to our chat room. Welcome to our live show. And don't forget, we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. And I'll give you a quick preview. Coming up, we've got Comet Watch, Planetary Radio, Naked Astronomers, and Naked Scientists following Space Pirate Radio. We got stuff to talk about tonight.
Oh, yeah. Big, big news story.
Yeah, do we want to start with the big stuff or just the sunny stuff?
Let's start with the sunny stuff. Let's keep ramp up everybody's anticipation.
Okay, let's see. Sunspots. Today we definitely have one sunspot. Yay! It's bad when it's a big celebration for an Earth-sized sunspot, let me tell you. That's what we got on there now. Active region 2638. Yes, one Earth-sized sunspot with a couple of little ones right next to it. So not too bad. Let me put that link into our chat room. I get it from the SOHO website. I'll put that link into our chat room so everybody can check out the sun right now. So not too bad. There was a reported of a big prominence on the sun a few days ago. Coronal hole in the sun. That's going to be sending particles out towards us. So northern latitude observers, get ready for some aurora. Checking out the solar wind speed. It'll be going up. I like watching this when we know we're going to get hit by more particles, more wind. So right now the solar wind is at 353 kilometers per second, a density of 5.08 protons per cubic centimeter. So if you go to the SOHO website and check out that solar wind gauge, you'll actually be able to see it rising over the next couple of days. Solar activity increases just because of a coronal hole, allowing more. Basically, the magnet fields open up and allow more stuff from the sun to stream through space. And when it's aiming at us, we get hit by those particles. Sunspot not kicking out much activity though, so that no chance for flares or anything like that. But at least it's something that will help you focus your telescope on. And I don't have to keep my computer screen moving up and down because the little dust particles look more like sunspots sometimes on my computer screen. Yeah, so let's see what we got. Oh, just checking space weather real quick. Also, a few near-Earth asteroids. Nothing too bad. Tomorrow, let's see, about 500,000 miles away, so a little bit more than two lunar distances. Kind of a big rock, 300 feet. Going to be passing by us. That's not too bad. The next big one, though, looks like around April the 19th. It's gonna be about 1 million miles away, but it is about 0.5 mile in diameter. I wonder if that one might possibly be visible. I'll keep you reported on that one. 1 million miles is a little far, but 0.5 mile diameter rock is usually visible at about that distance. So I'll keep you updated. And so we got a few months. It's not till April. The big rock flies by us. We'll see what happens.
I saw an iridium flare tonight.
Did you really? On purpose, yeah, or just happened?
No, I happened to look up right at the correct moment because it has been unusually warm in southeastern Michigan.
Pleasantly warm.
Hello, climate change. I'm not having a good time. I mean, yes, it is pleasant. It is temperate. It is not February weather. So my husband and I have been taking evening walks, and about two nights ago, I looked up and I saw a meteor. Well, just nice, random meteor, quite bright, bright about the brightness of Jupiter.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty bright, actually.
It was a bright meteor. I mean, it was no smoke trail, no visible, you know, disintegrating piece of rock, but it was a really good one, and this is in an area that has, pretty bad sky glow.
Uh-huh.
So, next night, we missed an iridium flare. It just happened to be, we were inside, I think, having dinner, and then we came out and he checked his phone. Oh, hey, we missed one. So this time we were walking, and we both happened to look up at the exact moment to see a brilliant object, brighter than Jupiter, slightly yellow in color above us. And I'm doing all the mental calculations. Okay, not Venus, not this, not Arcturus. What? Oh, and it fades out. So, I'm going to miss them all when they're gone.
They're going?
Yes, they're going. They are being...
Oh, I did hear that.
Oh, well, we covered it a couple of weeks ago. Maybe we ran out of time. Yes, the iridium flares are being replaced.
Let's go back and explain what iridium flares are first to everybody.
Yep, they're satellites. So they're man-made objects that are known for their array of solar panels that make things very, very bright.
Well, it makes the satellite really bright.
Yeah, they catch the sun, they flash it down into your eyes, lasts a few seconds, and then as the angle changes, they fade out.
Right. So the iridium system is going away then?
They are these satellites with the telltale solar panels are being replaced by a newer generation of a different design that will not cause these amazing displays of, basically light pollution, but they're cool.
Yeah, it's kind of a mixed thing about even though they're sort of like really slow artificial meteors, basically.
Yes.
So they're kind of nice to look at once you kind of get used to them. It was like, okay, something fun. Like you could tell someone, hey, look up there. There's going to be an extremely bright star moving across the sky in just a minute and get to see it and impress your friends and stuff like that. So are they actually going to bring them down?
I don't. No, let me check on that. As I said, we had that article queued up a couple of weeks ago when they put, I think, the first of the new ones up. But okay.
So we'll
it'll take a while. It'll take a few years. If the new ones work properly, it'll take a few years before they're all phased out.
Okay. So we'll see what happens if they stay in orbit. Well, they're still flaring, obviously. So if not, if they're going to bring them down on purpose or...
Well, Iridium Next is what they call the second-gen satellite, so it's going to be 66 of them. So, and they will not have the same, as I said, not have the same design. Okay. So the existing constellation of satellites is going to be operational until Iridium Next is fully online, and then they will go bye-bye. There's already some that are tumbling around. They're defunct.
Okay. Well, I did a little observing over the weekend because the weather was nice.
What did you see?
I went up, hit the countryside.
Nice.
And I thought, all right, well, I was just kind of hard to get away, so I got up there as fast as I could, grabbed as much equipment as I could, but mostly I just got regular small pair of binoculars and then my 20x80 binoculars, which are broken and I need to fix, so they sort of half work. And had some incredibly clear skies, only about an hour north of us here. So winter Milky Way. Basically 180 degrees from the galactic core zone. So that's Cassiopeia through, what is it, Orion, stuff like that. So the outer Milky Way, but I was able to see the Milky Way in those skies, which is pretty good because it's usually just moderately dark. But this was really crisp and clear, so I did as much scanning around as I could. Tried for some comets and didn't find any.
Ah.
Looking for Comet Encke. Mm-hmm. That was by Venus. So basically you went from Mars to Venus to the comet and couldn't find it. I didn't have exact positions. I just sort of tried to remember where they were. I need to get a printer for my computer and start printing out these comet charts and stuff like that. But I didn't do that. So I kind of just did some drawings about where it would be. Did not see Comet Encke. And then I went for 45P.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was. And yep. Again, I wasn't quite sure exactly where it was, but I kind of knew approximately. And I know I definitely looked at the spot where it was at, but didn't really stare at it, but I did not see it. So there was, I think it's Coma Berenices star cluster there, which is kind of like a Y-shaped group of stars, and its point was kind of heading north. So I followed the point up. I know it was basically north of there. Followed the point up, found a couple little double stars, and then I thought it was farther than that, and then went up to, again, it was like a couple of double stars right on the edge of visibility. I thought, well, they looked a little fuzzy. Maybe I thought I'd try a little later, but when I got home, I confirmed that, nope, that was definitely not even not just a double star. It was actually a tiny little asterism of stars. So
ah.
I kind of found a nice new asterism.
Cool.
But the comet turns out it was between Coma Berenices and the first double stars.
Hmm.
And I didn't like really stare between those two stars, but I, like half a dozen times, I went from Coma Berenices to the double stars and then beyond. So I did not see the comet in between the star cluster and that first double star. So it was just too faint. Have you seen it? You know, this was my first serious attempt. Well, without a telescope. Maybe if I had a telescope, would have seen it, but it's not binocular object even, I'd say. And my skies were moderately, reasonably dark, actually. That was skies.
We had a thoroughly legitimate night of observing Saturday night. We got an invitation from one of the members of the Ford Amateur Astronomy Club, which is also based at the Metro Detroit area. They have an observatory to the south of the main core of where everybody lives in Metro Detroit. We have an observatory, our club does, to the north, considerably farther out of town. So we've got nice eastern skies because of Lake St. Clair, nice northern skies. Mm-hmm. Pretty lousy western skies these days. I think they've actually degraded over the 10 years I've been a club member. In fact, I'm sure they have.
Mm-hmm.
And a terrible, washed out, awful southern sky because of this huge Metro Detroit sky dome. So this other club, they're a lot closer to the city core, but they have a good southern horizon. And so we got invited down there, and they've got a nice little freestanding dome on the grounds of a high school. And we were looking at objects in the little constellation underneath the feet of Orion the Hunter.
Lepus.
Lepus the rabbit. There is a little rabbit tucked underneath Orion's feet. I have looked for a Messier object, a globular cluster actually, in the rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Using a automated telescope, so there was no doubt whatsoever that it was focused on that object. It was invisible. There was nothing there. You could not see anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, turns out you have to go south of the light dome, and yes, you can indeed see it from Metro Detroit. No problemo. It was right there. You could even see some structure in it. It's a asymmetric globular cluster. There's a little sort of dark vein running down one side. So that was fun. And we also got to see Heinz Crimson Star, which is a very, very red little star in that same constellation, which I don't believe I had ever seen that before, so I got to check a new object off my list.
Mm-hmm.
That was nice.
Yep.
No comments, though.
I remember seeing that globular cluster before. Funny thing is, from where we are, the Detroit area, if you live north of Detroit, you look through the Detroit glow and can't see anything, but you can also travel a couple hundred miles north of Detroit and actually see better down to the south.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. You lose in latitude, but I can see stars in fairly extreme southern skies from we go up to the 45th parallel is where my husband and I tend to observe in dark skies. And yes, you are losing several degrees of the actual sky itself, but it's worth it to beat the sky glow.
Yeah, just lose a couple degrees, but you get much clearer skies almost to the horizon, especially if you get up around, like, looking over Lake Michigan, for instance. Done that before. So there's no city for about 400 miles. And that helps a lot, too. Not to get Chicago, but that's far enough down the horizon.
Right.
It?
Well, we have the lakes. So the lakes offer a wonderful buffer. And also, if you've got a lake horizon on a pristine night, you've got a lake horizon, and you really can't beat that.
So it's got some good observing in, but I could not find those cameras. Next time I will bring my telescope, and I'm getting the itch to rebuild my telescope again, my bigger telescope, my 17.5-inch telescope. Like, I just went to storage, and I found some parts that I had for it, so I'm going to start rebuilding it once again and see what I come up with for a new design this time. So, cool. Got to get it so I could pack it up. I had it built for a solid tube. And I decided, well, it was just getting to be too much to carry around at almost 18 inches. The tube is 18 inches. So I thought, all right, time to go with the truss tube design. But can I get it on the equatorial mount that I have for it? So, I don't know. Well, we'll see. I'm going to come up with some designs. And see what I'm going to come up with a Ponset design, too, or Ponce. A base that you put it on, and for about an hour, it'll equatorial drive the telescope. So if I can get one going for my 18, then I think I will up it to build one to go underneath the club's 22-inch. That's the plan.
Oh, boy.
So maybe we'll get some good use out of that big telescope. Especially if we can image with it a little bit. So that's the plan. See what happens. Let's see. So, no camera. Tried, but no,
but we got some observing in, which for Michigan in February, hey, not bad.
Yeah, it was just a couple of jackets and not really freezing. That's not so bad at all.
No.
I'll
remind you of that when it's 110 degrees in July.
I know. I am thinking it's really not that great to have 70 degrees in February because, like you said, 110 in July is even worse. I have seen people down – I know people down in Australia were reporting temperatures like that.
Well, it's aside from it, it's not healthful.
Yeah.
And, when you get the potential – for instance, Australia has been battling those raging wildfires.
Yes.
Michigan has had wildfires. We do not really want to find out what it's like to have wildfires in 110 degree weather. The other thing, of course, is because there's always a possibility that we could get hit with a cold snap, a real hard freeze in between now and, say, April.
Yes.
Goodbye cherry crop, goodbye apple crop, goodbye everything, because right now the whole world thinks that it's spring.
That's right. Trying to bloom. Saw robins a couple of days ago. That was one of our Michigan birds. When you see the first robin of the year, it's the first sign of one of the first signs of spring. So, about half a dozen of those. But yeah, they could just get frozen real quick.
Yeah. So not good. This is having maybe 2 days of 60 degree weather Fahrenheit we could have withstood without. But no, right now it's spring. It feels like May. It's February. This is terrible.
We'll see what happens, though, and how it affects us later.
Hopefully. Oh, yeah. I'm sure you'll be hearing from us as things get progressively weirder.
That's right.
Now, we've got some good news, or at least let's start off with some... Let's save the big story for after the break.
Okay.
So we don't run out of time. Little update on the Juno mission.
All right.
So, Juno's had some problems.
Juno's a robot going around Jupiter right now.
Yeah, so Juno is the mission to Jupiter. Juno, of course, is the wife of Jupiter, so she's paying a visit with a camera because she knows he's up to no good, as usual. No, really. It's Juno has been having some issues since October. So The craft is healthy. The science instruments are working great. The data is coming back. But it's not been able to get in the kind of orbit that it was supposed to. So it went into safe mode for a little bit. And now they're going to have, rather than risk firing the main engine, it will stay in the orbit that it's in. So it goes...
kind of a moderate orbit.
It's a moderate orbit. So it's completed 4 orbits so far. And the pictures have been phenomenal. So it goes close in at 4,100 kilometers over the cloud tops. And then it zooms far out past the orbit of Callisto, the outermost of the big 4 moons around Jupiter, 5 million miles away. So, yeah, we'll make do with that. It's still cool. It's just not quite getting the wonderful series of orbits that were like, kind of like slicing up Jupiter in little segments.
Yeah. I think they wanted to get a little closer too.
Oh yeah, they wanted to get a lot closer, certainly than beyond the orbit of Callisto. But the original plan, Juno was on would go into the atmosphere and go bye-bye in February of 2018. With these orbital tweaks, it may get an extension through July of 2018 and then maybe beyond that. So that we might get a lot more interesting science out of it.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Got a couple more people in chat I want to say hi to. We've got Kevin Unique, Plaidmac Optronics, and Ward Duke have recently joined us. So glad to have you here tonight, everybody. Well, since we're speaking of Jupiter, let's talk about observing Jupiter.
Yeah, it's now, back.
If you remember, it is definitely back. I was talking about observing the moons of Jupiter and referencing a website called InTheSky.org. And found an error in their diagram and contacted the author, Dr. Dominic Ford from Cambridge University in England. And he actually corrected the mistake that I saw on his chart. Let me put this you can go to InTheSky.org, it'd be in-the-sky.org, or just type InTheSky.org, it'll get you there. And there's under charts labeled Moons of Jupiter, and it's kind of a zigzag type of chart that has horizontal lines that represent the date, that would be 0 hour universal time, and then there's a gray bar that's vertical, that actually represents the planet Jupiter. And the swirly colored lines, red, yellow, orange, and blue, that represents the orbits of the moons, 4 brightest moons of Jupiter. So you can actually follow, and if you just basically go in a straight line across, it'll show you the position of the moons for that time. So you can kind of infer what the positions will look like when you look at it through your telescope. But you can also get some other information, too. For instance, when one of the lines crosses in front of the gray Jupiter line, that means just the planet. Sorry, the moon is actually passing in front of Jupiter, or and that's called a transit. Or when a curvy line goes behind Jupiter, yes, the moon actually does go behind Jupiter, and that's called an occultation. So I noticed that last week or the week before that the lines were backwards. What was supposed to go in front of Jupiter was shown as going in back of Jupiter and vice versa. So he did correct that, so it is nice and accurate. I use this a lot. For what's really interesting, I found on this one is the moon called Callisto shows up as the blue line. It's the one with the fourth moon. It's the farthest one out. Takes the longest to go around. Whenever Callisto goes behind Jupiter or in front of Jupiter on this chart, what that really means is because of the angle of the orbit of the plane of the moons, that moon will appear due north or due south of Jupiter. Usually when you look at Jupiter through a telescope, you can see some of the moons on the east side of Jupiter or some of the moons on the west side of Jupiter. Well, the way the orbit is right now, Callisto will not go in front of or directly behind Jupiter. It will actually pass north of it or south of it. It's a really unusual sight to see a moon parked right above Jupiter or right below Jupiter. And you could use this chart to figure out when that's going to happen. So check that out. It's actually pretty cool. They also have there's another spot on in this guide.org. It's a planet orrery, a 3D diagram, which is kind of interactive. You can click on that, and you can tilt it so you can actually see what the solar system looks like from the North Pole of the Sun. You can basically click and drag the solar system so you see an edge on. You can do it at any angle. You can also click and drag and make the planets circle around. So you can actually see how the planets look like from basically anywhere around the solar system. It's kind of fun to just kind of click it and move it around and see the different angles that the planets make with each other. I like it because sometimes you actually will see planetary alignments using this thing.
Yeah, and Black Projects from a chat room, he was the one who issued the correction, right? Or got in contact with the site maintainer to get the orbits fixed.
I think several people did, because I couldn't get his email to work on the website. It wouldn't click, and it wouldn't go there, and I just tried copying and pasting it, and it wouldn't go there. So I did message him on Skype, and he did instant message me back. So I think that may have been some influence of other people contacting him, too.
Well, that's cool. Yeah. Props to everybody who participated in getting that correct, because it's an excellent resource, but as we said last week, it was flopped.
So. It was inaccurate, yeah. So now it's good. So, yep, I do recommend it.
Brilliant.
Now I want to take on the United States Naval Observatory.
Good luck with that one.
We'll see, because once in a while I do believe I see mistakes on the positions of the moon, our moon, with planets. And I'm going to keep on top of this a little bit more. I'm going to check out some ways of confirming my information. We have several different methods. And if I see some errors, which I'm really positive I've seen errors in the past, that I will see if I can contact them and report the errors and see if they acknowledge the errors or if it was just something that I seem to have got wrong, which I always approach that too. When I approached Dr. Ford, I said, I think this is wrong. I strongly believe this is wrong. Could you check it and see and acknowledge it? Yeah, this is wrong. So I had a couple of people check it too, and yeah, it seemed wrong. So I always like to confirm, because even something that basically seems obviously wrong, it might be just looking at it the wrong way, and it might be sort of correct type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You always want to be cautious when you're telling the website owner, hey.
Okay. Oh, Black Project says he sent him an email. Could you also Mark, I didn't do this, but could you have him check his email link on inthesky.org, since it doesn't work for me? Maybe it works for somebody in the UK, but it didn't actually work for me. So could you maybe have him check, say, if anybody wants to contact him about the website, have him double check his email link and make sure it will actually click. See, okay, Nick said it worked for him. Okay, now when I clicked on the website, it didn't seem to go there. Let me try clicking on it right now, down near the very bottom there, and it's not highlighting. It says website designed by. There's his email address, and it's not highlighting. So I don't know. Did you find it a different way, Mark, or Nick? You just copy link location. I don't know. So maybe check around the website and see if you can just click. You should be able to just click on his email address and go there, because that was all I could find for his email addresses on there. He also writes for the BAA, British Astronomical Association? I think he's the web editor. Oh, he had to turn off his ad blocker to get it. So, okay. I thought mine was off, but I'll try that too.
Cool.
But anyways, right. he also does the website for the British Astronomical Association newsletter too. It is halfway through. So we should do our station identification, as in you are listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is now 9:30 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, Wednesday evening, February the 22nd, 2017. So universal time, that would be 2:30 in the morning on February the 23rd, 2017. Halfway through our program, stick around. We've got another half hour. If you did miss the first half hour, don't worry. We repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So you can always catch us on the repeat if you like. Don't forget, more programming coming up after Space Pirate Radio. We've got Comet Watch. We've got Planetary Radio, Naked Astronomers, and Naked Scientists, all coming up after Space Pirate Radio. So stick around. And of course, stick around with us too. Got another half hour of our live program. And of course, welcome to everybody in our chat room tonight. We've got me and you. We've got Black Projects, Sky Guy Nick, Twist Edge, Glenn, Evil Spock, Observing Space, Plaid Sister, Plaid Joan, Kevin Unique, Plaid Mac, Optronics, and Orduke in tonight. So glad to have you here. Let's see, is Optronics up still here? Hopefully you'll be able to, as I mentioned before, there is a annular solar eclipse coming up, I think it's on the 26th of February, down about, a 1,000 miles-ish or so south of Buenos Aires in South America. So anybody that can get down around that area to see annular solar eclipse, I really recommend it. Annulars are more common than a total solar eclipse, but still not all that common, especially when you have a very little landmass to go across. So you have less opportunities to get in the pathways. And it is kind of pretty far south, too. So hopefully some of you you'll be able to actually see that one and get some pictures, too. Oh, let's ski. Okay. Let's do.
Wait, we got the big article. Let's do the big article.
You want to do the big article, or and then we'll do a rundown of where the planets and the moon are in the sky after that.
Sure.
Okay. So the big article.
Yeah. So NASA had an announcement today about a little solar system with not one, not two, not three, but 7 Earth-sized planets.
Yes, indeed.
So it's a red dwarf called TRAPPIST-1. And it's actually a very small red dwarf, slightly larger than Jupiter. And last May, it was announced that they thought that there were 3 planets around it. Well, the results of in-depth study into this system were published today in the journal Nature. And it's got 7 of them. And since it is such a tiny and cool star, these little planets close in, we're talking orbital periods of 1.5 days for TRAPPIST-1b, the planet. Hey, it's a small, cool star. That would be its likely Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, this is cool.
Yeah, very cool. Unlike anything else that's been studied to this point.
Some of the observations were by Spitzer satellite, which observes in the infrared, and some ground-based observations kind of all combining together to see these planets. Let's see, I get a couple of jokes about this. Oh, yes, the name of the show tonight will be called Planet Parenthood. So, and what else did I have? Another joke for this
I was going to joke about Trappist Belgian Ale, but, you know, hey, I always look for an excuse for some Belgian Ale.
Oh, yes. We will have a song at the end of the show, kind of a tribute song to related to this article. So try to remember when you hear the exit music and what the name of the title is, if you can remember. Like, oh, I know my other joke about this star. So if the star, all the planets around this star was kind of like a family, and if they were all boys, it would be the only star with 7 sons.
That's true. Yep. You could also make a 7 dwarves joke.
Oh, I could do that too. Yeah, they're in the Goldilocks zone.
Trappist-1 and the 7 dwarves.
Yeah, because and they're all in the zone.
Bears, not dwarves. Bears. Anyway.
Got a question. Don't red dwarfs bathe in radiation in the Goldilocks zone? Yeah, there's some question about planets in a Goldilocks zone around a wet red dwarf. Even though it's a small star, they're actually pretty close. They're like basically closer than Mercury is to the sun.
Much closer.
Yeah, so they're in the good heat zone, but are they getting zapped by radiation? Or are they tidally locked? Basically meaning one side of the planet always faces towards the sun, so radiation wouldn't affect it that much on the nighttime side. What's the weather pattern like if they're tidally locked? Stuff like that. A lot of questions. These planets, if they're Earth size, do they have plate tectonics, which would also might mean that they have a good magnetic field to, you know, defer some of that radiation? Hard to say.
But well, as we've pointed out in the past, Venus is in the habitable zone.
Yes.
We're pretty confident saying there's nothing there.
Yes, but it also has an excessive amount of atmosphere.
Right.
So what if it had less atmosphere and a lot of magnetic field?
So it is thought that because of where they're at, the 1E, 1F, and 1G planets are the likeliest to be habitable. So it goes B, C, D, well, F, G. D has a really weird orbit, too. So E, F, and G may be the best candidates. It's possible that it's got more than seven planets that they've just haven't been detected yet. This is going to be a very likely target for the James Webb Space Telescope when it finally launches.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's fascinating. And you mentioned the radiation, Marty. So red dwarfs, they are small stars, cool stars, exceptionally long-lived stars. They can also be some pretty dramatic little stars. They can flare. Proxima Centauri is an example of an actively flaring star, which that's not good for any planets or any life on any planets around it. This appears to be a far less active red dwarf, more active than, say, the Sun, which is a pretty well-tempered star, luckily for us, but not necessarily flaring out all over the place and toasting any potential life with radiation, acute radiation.
Yeah. Black Project's saying this is smaller than a red dwarf. Well,
They're saying it's only a little bit larger than Jupiter. That is one small, small star.
Well,
small, yeah. And quote-unquote ultra cool.
It's got to be I think it's above a brown dwarf, though. A brown dwarf does not have nuclear reactions, so I think it would still classify as a red dwarf, but definitely on the lower end.
Definitely on the lower end.
So if it has nuclear fusion, it would still be a star and not just a blob of mass. So I think I would still call it red dwarf, but I would have to check out the designation to it more specifically. I'm sure it's in one of those zones that are just kind of a blend of a couple different types of things where there's really no defining edge to it.
Yeah, I mean, they call it an ultra-cool dwarf star in the article, so I'm like, okay, I'll use their terminology, but I admit a star, an actual star in the same size as Jupiter that's weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, it's in the constellation of Aquarius.
Ah!
Which I'm trying to think, is that out now? Well, that's in the morning sky, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Wait, where's... Yes, because Arcturus, Pegasus is there, Pisces is near Aquarius, so yes, it would be a little bit more in the morning sky, I do believe, if I can remember. Or wait, where is that? No, I was just looking at Pegasus. That might be in our evening sky, Aquarius, then, right around.
I think it's bordering on, at least where we are, not very visible. I mean, it's a prominent evening constellation in autumn. And here we are toward the end of February.
Yeah, I think I was looking at Pegasus right around Venus, if I'm not mistaken. So,
rapidly receding in the...
Yeah, that puts it sunset. In the northeast for us after sunset, if I'm not mistaken.
It'll be really well positioned come like October.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to point. I wonder what the visual, what the magnitude of this object is. It's got to be pretty faint, the visual magnitude for us here on the Earth. Got to be pretty faint. Being basically as red as it is, it's not going to be a very big star. And I don't remember how far away they said it was. Was it 40 light years, I think? Something like that? Have to look that up, get a little bit more information on it.
Yeah, I'm not putting this on my list of things to look at with my eyeballs.
That's right. They hyped it quite a bit, but I'm glad they're not overhyping the potential of life on it and aliens and all that when it gets kind of over the top and gets a little bit too stupid then, you know. Sometimes they say, oh, these are probably got aliens on it. Like, don't even say that. I always hated predictions like that. I always hated space travel predictions.
It's always 20 years out, Marty.
Yeah, always 20 years out, and we're already going to another star in 20 years. Oh, just another 20 years, we're going to be traveling to the stars. Like,
okay, yeah. The apparent magnitude of this is 18.8.
Okay.
Good luck.
Pretty faint. That's photographic, though. Let's see, where's it go? All right, let's give a little rundown on what's up in the sky for moon and planets and stuff like that.
Venus looks amazing. It still looks amazing. It looks absolutely phenomenal.
Yep. Still has Mars to its northeast. And keep on going just a little bit farther, you've got the planet Uranus. So let's see next week, Uranus will actually be 4 degrees north of the moon. Coming up Tuesday before that, so next Tuesday, Venus will be 10 degrees north of the moon. This coming Monday, Mars will be 0.6 degrees north of Uranus. Ooh, Mars and Uranus are getting really close, so just about a moon's diameter in between Mars and Uranus come next Monday, February the 27th, so get your scopes out for that one. This Sunday, new moon with an eclipse, as I reported. And then tomorrow we've got Jupiter 4 degrees north of Spica.
That's pretty. Jupiter is, they already look quite nice in the evening together. And 4 degrees, that should be
as bright as Spica is, when you put a planet like Jupiter there.
Oh, comparison.
It really outshines it.
Yeah.
Big time. Just like Venus really outshines Mars. But it's nice I had my binoculars and my 20 power binoculars on Mars, and it was like, it's still looking quite red. I'm sure through a telescope, it's not going to be very big, but Mars still looks nice and red. It's hanging out for a kind of a long time. In fact,
it's not going to look good until 2019. Sorry.
There was something from MRO about Mars recently, too. I can't remember what that article was. Checking the NASA website here real quick.
Well, while you look for that, you mentioned Sunday, and I wanted to give a shout-out to the Imaloa Astronomy Center on the Big Island of Hawaii, a wonderful museum for both astronomy and Polynesian observing and Polynesian culture. It is having its 11th annual birthday party this Sunday from 9 to 4. So if you are so lucky as to be in Hawaii right now, check it out. It will be free of charge. They got a local store to sponsor it, so they've got planetarium shows, they've got a scavenger hunt, and it's a really nice place.
All right, here's a little article from MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Observatory, about a new impact on the planet Mars on a dusty slope.
Ooh.
Let me get this into our chat room here, and you can also just get this off the NASA website too, so check that out. New impact site detected on Mars. Let's see, sometimes impacts on the dusty slopes will actually cause a bit of a dust avalanche. Just kind of an off topic, I'm going to be getting some dirt that I think really simulates Martian soil.
Oh,
one of our exhibits.
Okay.
Basically, it's a way of showing glaciers carve into the land by pushing rocks around.
Okay.
So we, So we've got this table, has a glass cover it, magnet on top, and underneath is a steel ball. And you basically use the magnet to make, you know, grooves in the sand underneath. Well, the thing has been going for probably 10, 15 years. The steel ball has been rusting. It's been grinding away the sand into an extremely fine powder. So we're going to change it out real soon. I'm going to get some of the stuff. This stuff is nasty. I could take a spoonful of it, pour it into a cup, and have the area about a foot around the table be covered in red dust.
Well, yeah, that's what it's going to be like when astronauts or cosmonauts or whoever get up there, taikonauts.
Yeah, this is what's thought like.
Nasty dust.
Yeah, so the stuff is really fine. It blows around. It gets into everything. So I'm going to get some of the stuff. I'm going to get the old stuff, and I will do some demonstrations on what the Mars dust might be like. Maybe I'll build a box for it, and like a clear plexiglass box, and put some stuff in there, and blow the sand around, and we can see how it gets into all kinds of mechanisms and things like that, and how hard it is to keep out.
That's what the Apollo moonwalkers experienced dealing with the moon. Moon got everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Nice shiny lunar lander. Too bad. Moon got everywhere.
Yep. Oh, one more Jupiter's moon site I want to mention too, called Project Pluto.
Yeah.
I know it's about Pluto, but yeah, it's got some really good lists of Jupiter's moon's events, like when one of the moons goes into a shadow of Jupiter, it's called an eclipse. The moon goes in front of Jupiter, it's called a transit. Goes behind it, it's called an occultation. Well, this lists all of them that are happening. And if you go down this list, you can see when special events are going to happen on Jupiter. Kind of fun to watch a moon all of a sudden be next to Jupiter, and then a minute later, it's just gone. It looked like it just disappeared. Well, it did. It went into the shadow of Jupiter. So kind of fun to watch them.
It is.
Yep. Some unusual things happen this time, like right now, Io, it will actually go into eclipse, into the shadow of Jupiter, and it won't come out, won't be visible again until it travels all the way behind Jupiter and then pops out from the other side. And if you watch these charts really carefully, scroll down through them and check them very carefully, sometimes you could see multiple events happening at once. So you might have one moon going in the shadow, you might have another moon going in front of Jupiter, and you might have another moon coming out from the front of Jupiter, all within several minutes. But you kind of have to go down the chart and look at the times of these events and look for like multiple events happening within a short period of time. It's pretty cool to watch like three things happen on Jupiter at the same time.
We had a triple transit. Was that 2016 or 2015?
I think it was 16.
It was 15.
Was it? Was in the winter then?
It was in the winter. It was cold, and we were out there using our club's 8-inch refractor telescope for one of its first significant outings.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. It was cloudy, and we were looking at it through clouds. Jupiter actually, I think, looked blue. But you could make out the three little shadows. So that's special. Double transits are fairly common, actually. Triple transit is really special. Quadruple transit, not possible.
It could also tell when opposition is of Jupiter. And what you can get some really cool events at opposition, you could have actually one of the moons pass its shadow on Jupiter. So, for instance, the shadow will start to go across Jupiter, then the moon will start to go across Jupiter, and then the moon will actually pass its shadow right at occultation if you get the right timing of the events happening at that time. I've actually seen that before, and it's actually pretty cool. So I wonder when opposition for Jupiter actually is. Let's see. So right now, let's see, February. We've got the shadow is starting. Let's see. Let me get down to around where we're at here, the 23rd. So let's see. We've got a shadow at 5:07, and then the moon goes at 6:03. So that's about an hour. So let me scroll down a little bit more. Let's go into March. Let's see. We still have the shadow starting 49 minutes later. The moon goes in front, so let's skip into the end of March. I'm basically just looking at the one. I still got going there. Yeah, I can tell when opposition is going to be. Okay, end of March, separated by 20 minutes. You know, like right now it's an hour. We now and then March, we've got a 20-minute separation. All right, let's see. Shadow. Oh, here we go. Getting real close here. On April the 4th, the shadow starts, and then the transit happens 5 minutes later. And still shadow. All right, so we've got to go on the next event. This might be it. Shadow transit. Nope. Getting close, though, right around April. Transit. No, I don't see it here. I'll keep checking, though. I got a few months to give everybody the information. But, yeah, it's actually pretty cool when things happen the same day. Oh, here we go. April the 8th. The transit starts at 10:57 and the shadow starts at 10:57. So we actually have the shadow and the moon going in front of Jupiter at exactly the same time. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Interesting. Then you could tell like if it's, if the moon is like north or south of our point of view. So it's actually cool to watch one of the moons have its, go across Jupiter over the top of its shadow too. But I'll get you any more accurate data than that. We'll see what happens.
Cool. Good. Hey, yeah. So got a little follow-up on in memory of John Glenn, of course, the first American to orbit the Earth in space and thereby became an American hero and later a senator and later a shuttle astronaut. Hmm. Well, an astronomy park is going to be dedicated to him.
Nice.
So private donors raised the money, and so groundbreaking is going to take place early this spring. And it was already in the works, so several years had gone into the planning, but it will be a permanent tribute to hopefully inspire new generations of night sky gazers and explorers. So that's cool. It's Ohio, of course, has many major metropolitan areas. This one is going to be set in Hocking Hills, which is relatively free of light pollution, according to OSU, Ohio State University astrophysicist Paul Sutter. So it's one of the darkest parts of Ohio. That would be nice. So it's hopefully it will also be designated as a dark sky preserve and thereby stay good and dark. But this is a very appropriate tribute to, you know, one of the last of the original wave of space explorers.
Cool.
Yeah. And a place for those of us in Michigan to check out when it's ready to go. Ah, John Twist Edge in the chat room brings up Pluto. I had this up my sleeve, Marty, if you don't mind.
It's okay. I've heard this before, and I like, well, we'll wait and see if it really happens or not.
Well, and it definitely made the news. It made my news feed. Pluto to be redefined as a planet. Okay. So first off, you look, who's agitating for this?
Yes. And who says this is going to happen or who says somebody thinks it's going to happen?
One of the people agitating for it is Alan Stern, principal investigator of New Horizons mission. Okay. So he's a powerful voice.
A little bit of motivation there, though.
Bit of motivation there. And then you've got, of course, we're not even going to go into the whole new Planet Nine camp with Mike Brown and his researchers looking for another ninth planet to be the real ninth. Not going there. But so it's picking up sympathy in the media, but the International Astronomical Union has not weighed in on this that I've seen. I've seen a lot of commentary on the need to redefine planets. In fact, I've got an article here from bad astronomer Phil Plait, from his new home in blaster.com. And that's cool. I agree with Stern that the definition that the IAU uses is dumb. I don't agree with it either. But unless you do a full-scale rebellion against them and say, we don't care what you think anymore, we declare our own means of nomenclature, or you somehow convince them that they are wrong. They're wrong. It's not going to happen.
No, I don't really agree with the definition of a planet for the IAU, but I do think Pluto does not fit into the standard planet parameters for other reasons. Like it's more like a moon that happens to be orbiting around the sun. a very elliptical orbit, a very tilted orbit. Now they were talking about stuff like clearing out its path. I don't necessarily agree with that one, but this is just like a, you know, very crooked, sloppy orbit for Pluto, and I don't really include it in. It was basically Ceres was started out as a planet too, and that was not, and you know, that was demoted too.
I would be perfectly fine with categorizing Ceres and Pluto and Eris, and if this other Planet Nine is out there, it's obviously wouldn't be Planet Nine; it would be Planet 13, whatever, because it's going to have one heck of a weird orbit too. If it exists.
I know.
So I'm perfectly happy with calling them planets. It's just I can call them that. The textbook is going to say you're wrong. And the 6 year olds are going to continue to tell me I'm wrong because that's not what the official word is.
Depends on if they grew up with Pluto being a planet or not.
6 year olds did not grow up with Pluto being a planet. 11 year olds
at
this point have not grown up with Pluto being a planet.
That's right. So I would say I still think Pluto I would only consider it a traditionally called a planet, but not by scientific definitions. So
I think any definition that includes Mercury, us, Jupiter, Neptune, and whatever is lurking out there in the trans-Neptunian object ring is, I'm not going to say it's bogus, but it's sketchy.
We'll see. What's the definition? What's the defining line when you call it a planet and a planet not? I was thinking Planet X. Was that mean like Planet Mysterious or Planet 10?
Both.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, if the solar system has, ends up with, a couple thousand planets, is that really mean we have a couple thousand planets, because every round ball out there in the Kuiper Belt and Oort cloud is now considered a planet?
I think the spherical, the argument that it has to be sufficiently large to become a sphere, and of course we are not a perfect sphere, none of them are perfect spheres, that's fair.
What if it's sphere by luck?
What do you mean sphere by luck?
not by gravity. But
look,
it just happened to be mostly round.
I'm
going to
blow your mind, Marty. Did you hear the big story in Earth science for this week?
Mm-mm.
There's 8 continents.
Oh, yes. I heard this. Another
continent. Okay. So we've all learned 7 continents, 7 continents, 7 continents. Okay, there's 8 now. We all got to learn Zealandia. We'll live.
Exactly.
We'll live.
Well, then, like, what size of, crust is considered a continent?
Well, this one fit.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's still pretty big, but if it's a mile by a mile, a chunk of crust that's cracked, and so you have like an island continent, is it still a continent if it's only 1 mile by 1 mile? And then turns out there's thousands of these little island continents around the world. Would that count? Maybe. Maybe not.
I don't think we're going to solve this in the last 90 seconds of the show.
I don't think so. Too bad I don't have a pyramid story to end this on. So. All right, don't forget our ending song coming up here, and see if you can tie it into our discussion on what's that thing called? Travesty One or something like that?
Trappist.
Trappist, yeah.
Yeah, in honor of really good beer.
By the way, stuff is going to the International Space Station real quick here, so keep on top of the NASA TV for cargo going to the International Space Station this week, tomorrow morning too, maybe. So we'll see what happens. Oh, where's my clock here? I gotta keep track of time. All right, looks like we're definitely getting down there. So I want to say thanks to everybody in our chat room tonight. Really appreciate you all being here. Again, we consider you part of our crew when you come into a chat room during Space Pirate Radio. So thanks, everybody, for joining us tonight.
Yeah, it was hopping tonight.
Yep,
party on board.
All right. Grog. Lots of grog. We repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So you can listen in and more stuff. Comet Watch coming right up. All right, everybody. We're out of here. Appreciate you being here. Thanks. Good night, all.
Clear skies, y'all.
Close and I can squeeze you tight. Make love to you both day and night. Heal the sick and raise the dead and make the little girls talk out of their head. I'm the one. I'm the one.
so sweet. Make a little heart skip a beat. Heal the sick and raise the dead. And make every woman talk out of their head. I'm a woman. I'm a woman. And I'm a woman. I'm a woman. The one that calls seven sons.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy. Around the world and across the known universe, this is Astronomy.fm Radio.
AFM.